The World Health Organization defines addiction as a chronic relapsing condition. Dahab Private Hospital recognizes that addiction is a multifaceted illness affecting an individual's physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, social, and practical well-being. With 28 and 90-day residential rehabilitation programs and Dahab's accredited private health fund approved treatment service, you or your loved one can get the help you need to navigate the rehabilitation process to regain control, to overcome that addiction, and to take back your life. If this resonates, then take the first step and call Dahab Private Hospital for addiction treatment. Addiction is treatable and recovery is possible. 1-800-329-422 or dahab.com.au. Dahab is one word, D-A-Y-H-A-B, dahab.com.au. G'day team, welcome to another instalment of You Know What with You Know Who. Hi Melissa.
Hello, how are you going?
I'm going pretty well, and I know you're going terrific because you just told Bobby that, which may or may not be a lie, but you're very brave because you've been a little bit crook. We won't go into it, but when you're crook, you're like a soldier. I'm like a great big baby. That's okay.
Not true, but...
That's kind of true. I just avoid things. There's this weird lump though. Nah, it'll go for sure.
That sounds a lot like my strategy.
Yeah, I know. Peas, pod. Before we get underway with our guest, one of my best friends on the planet, Robert Cappuccio, let me just tell you folks, on May 5, we're kicking off our new series, which is called The Excellence Series for Awesome Humans, great thinkers, great teachers, great coaches, great mentors. Kicking off May 5, which is a Wednesday night, and then every Wednesday night for the three subsequent weeks, so 4 weeks in total, Ashok Gupta, Dr. Amy Silva, Lisa Tarmady, and Dinesh Palepana, one of our faves, all here to share the love. 4 weeks, as I said, 8 o'clock on Wednesday nights till about 9:30 or 10. They're going to do a presentation, share some thoughts and ideas and stories and messages. Then there's going to be Q&A for as long as they can cope. We would love you to get involved. Go to the website, go to events, click on the thingy, click on the other thingy, and boom, you're in. Are you going to book in, Bobby?
I can't wait. So is this like the average series? Am I like a warm-up building up to the excellence?
Well, yeah, this is welcome to the average series with Bobby and Harps. If you want mediocrity, we're here for you. That's right.
Straight for the middle.
Well, we like to give people contrast between the mediocre series and the excellent series.
Yeah, compared to that wanker last week, these guys are amazing.
How are you, my friend? Are you all right?
Doing all right. How's it going?
Yeah, we're going pretty good. Australia right now is going pretty well in terms of all the kind of, in the context of the global situation. I feel we are very blessed, fortunate, lucky, use whatever adjective you want. But we are, you know, not everyone, of course, but as, you know, comparing country to country, I think we're in a really good place. So I'm very grateful.
Talking about contrast shaping your perspective, you guys are doing really well. I mean, compared to where you were just a few short months ago. Over here as well, to be fair.
Yeah. Well, I think I don't know if we have any active cases in the whole country right now. So Victoria's great. Oh, there's a few in Queensland, aren't there, Melissa?
I think.
Or WA.
I think there might be maybe two or so in Perth, but nothing like substantial like other countries, that's for sure.
Yeah. Did you just hear that dude outside my window using a power tool?
No.
Oh, good.
I get those all the time, the leaf blowers.
I'm like, come on, bro. It's like it's been silent all morning and we're 4 minutes in. What's the update over there, mate, in terms of COVID? Are the numbers coming down? Is the mayhem subsiding or is it vary state to state?
Numbers are coming down. The vaccine rollouts are moving along quite readily and things are opening up. You know, they're starting to open up. So
how's California overall?
Yeah, just a lot better than it was a few months ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, people are out again, you know, there's, you know, gyms are opening. So we're moving forward. We're making progress.
Are you getting back in the gym?
I will at some point. I'm really enjoying training in my garden right now, to tell you the truth. I've got a couple of vipers, you know, I've got some kettlebells. I've got, you know, physio ball tubing, and I'm just, you know, having a go of it.
Now, our fitness peeps, and I know what a viper is, but about probably 80% of our audience think that you've either got some kind of serpent or reptile out there or a Dodge Viper, which is a car. But
that's what I meant.
Yeah, right. What's a from a training point of view, what's a viper?
It's a long cylindrical tool with a lot of versatility in how you can load the body at different force vectors to strengthen various positions that might be harder without the versatility of a tool like that. Mm. It's cool. I like it.
It's didn't Michol develop that?
Yeah, Michol Dalcourt.
Yeah.
IOM. So he's got Viper as well. I mean, I'm starting to really appreciate the importance of positional loading and positional strengthening. So for a while I was a lot more functional than at other points in my life. And then I went back to my traditional lifting just because I like to do it. And then, as you know, a couple of years ago, I sustained a quite serious training injury that changed my workouts forever. I was probably having a midlife crisis. I told my wife I should have bought the Porsche, but you know, I decided to wreck myself instead. And so my training methodology has shifted quite a bit.
It's interesting how with, you know, functional training, which is a very broad term and really covers a lot of stuff, but versus old school traditional bodybuilding type training, how when you get a weight away from your center of gravity, how heavy that weight becomes.
Well, the weight in the hand is never an indication of the load on the body.
Yeah.
You know, so if you look at torquing forces, you know, you look at moment arms force angles, it's like, well, if you have like 5 kilos in your hand, it never within that rotatory arc of motion weighs, you know, 5 kilos, does it?
Exactly. Well, exactly. There are so many variables around that, and it messes with people's head, the notion that 5 kilos isn't always 5 kilos.
Yeah, and then you got to add like speed, rotational inertia, all of these factors, you know, biomechanics come into it. So you could create quite a lot of force with relatively little load.
So we weren't going to talk about physiology or training. We were going to talk about the revelation that you had around, amongst other things. So your podcast, of course, is the Self-Help Antidote. And I think, I don't know if we talked about this on air or we started and we got sidetracked, as is our way, or you and I talked on a phone call one day about like what that means, the Self-Help Antidote, and the genesis for the idea, for the title, for the conversation, for the show. So what was your thinking around that term?
Well, I think I first had that insight back when I went to see a film with a friend of mine, Morgan, and I was getting progressively more and more frustrated with the self-help industry, not because the industry in and of itself is wrong. You know, it's got some great information, and for some people in certain contexts, and I do believe that context is everything, or at least it's quite significant, it was either insufficient or completely inappropriate. And it seemed like there was this model that self-help was trying to fit everybody into. And I had a lot of issues with that. I'll just say that. And I was in Denver just working at one of our offices was out in Denver, Colorado at the time. And I had a friend of mine, still do, my friend Morgan. And it was a Sunday. She's like, why don't we go see a film? Let's go see Midnight in Paris. And one of the things I was looking forward to is Midnight in Paris. It's, you know, it's kind of like he goes back in time. So it's contemporary, but it's also sort of a period piece if you've ever seen the film. And we were seeing at the Mayan Theater, which is this 1920s art deco, which is kind of like the period where that film, half the film takes place in. I thought, oh, that'll be cool. You know, I love cinema. So I went to cinema with Morgan, and there was this one pivotal scene in the film where like she had to yell at me. She's like, get up. If you can't be quiet, you got to leave. I just started freaking out because it's where the lead character, Gil, played by Owen Wilson, meets Gertrude Stein, which was for him one of his idols growing up, played masterfully by Kathleen Bates. I think that's redundant. You know, everything's played masterfully by Kathleen Bates. And he shows her this novel that he's been working on, and she tells him that he has this beautiful voice. I mean, coming from anyone, that's a compliment. Coming from Gertrude Stein, that comment's life-changing. So the character is just overwhelmed. But then she comes over the top and she chastises and says, "You have much too beautiful a voice to be such a defeatist." And you know, he starts to argue with her because his past is her future. Like, she hasn't seen the horrors of the 20th century. You know, she hasn't seen the rise of, you know, Nazi Germany. She hasn't seen Stalin, Pol Pot, America's Got Talent. Now that's actually, that's unfair. So, but he has. So looking in retrospect, he starts making his case for why life is sometimes empty and why life is sometimes cruel. And what I love is she doesn't argue with him. She concedes to this, but then she says, "This is not for you because you've chosen the life of an artist." And I think in a lot of respects, we're all artists, especially within the design of our own life, our value system. And she says, "It is not the job of the artist to succumb to despair. The job of the artist is to find an antidote for the emptiness of existence." And I was like, holy wow. Shit. That transcends everyone.
Just say that again. The job of the artist, say that again.
It is not the job of the artist to succumb to despair. The job of the artist is to find the antidote to the emptiness of existence.
Wow.
And think about that. That doesn't deny anyone's reality. That doesn't tell them to think differently. That doesn't tell them that they are broken. That doesn't tell them that they are flawed. It is acknowledging each individual's reality and showing respect to it. And at the same time, making the case that whatever it is that's burdening you, and we all have burdens and we all have challenges, out of that burden comes that responsibility, because the last thing you need and the last thing the world around you needs and the last thing the world in its entirety needs is the thing that is causing you more suffering and despair. The last thing that a frightened world needs is one more frightened person. The last thing that an angry or cruel world needs is one more angry and cruel person. And so it's this acknowledgement. And it's also a path. And it just goes back to, you know, there are certain quotes that I've come across and I'm like, that's it. That is beautifully articulated. And when I heard that, it's quite different than the way it was stated. But it goes back to a quote that I heard from Charles Baudelaire's essay on getting drunk. And it says, "Get drunk. This is the great imperative. If you do not want to feel time's horrid fatal bruise upon your shoulders, crushing you into the earth, get drunk and stay that way." And then he goes on to say, on what, you ask? Wine, poetry, virtue? It doesn't matter. Just get drunk. Now, when I first heard that quote, I took that literally. I don't really remember much of that year, but
you're an idiot.
I reread it. And to me, I think that's the essence of life.
So to get intoxicated on something that...
intoxicates you? Yeah. Like Paul Taylor is intoxicated on neuroscience. Well, yeah. Not just neuroscience, but yeah. He finds neuroscience intoxicating and he goes and he lives there as deep as he can, as often as he can. And that creates this timeless state. So, like, you're completely present when you're face-to-face with that which intoxicates you.
So that was the world's longest answer to why did you call your podcast what you did.
That was pretty long, wasn't it?
But that's all right. No, because you gave us some context. So what, and this is not an ad for the self-help antidote, although it can be. But so what? So what is the antidote? Like, what are the conversations that you want to have, or what are the what are the conversations that you think we should have? Because we both work, and so many people that you and I know. I mean, self-help, it's, I don't like the term either. Well, I don't know if you like it. I don't really like it because I think it's misrepresented, it's misunderstood, it's used and abused. And it's, you know, for me, self-help is literally the process of an individual helping themselves. So I don't really, I'm very aware that it's a brand.
Which kind of defeats the point of buying the book, doesn't it?
Well, maybe the book is a tool to help you help yourself. But you're talking to an author, so I could be biased, right?
I was just being cheeky.
All right. No, but, well, yeah, you're being cheeky, but you're also being insightful, because I've said to many people, my book will not change your life. My program will not change your life. I will not change your life. My insight, wisdom, if I have any direction, education, support, encourage, it won't. But what I might do is be a small asset or tool along your journey that, you know, is of some value. But am I going to change you? No. And I think this is the thing that bothers me and perhaps you is this notion that, one, there's a best way, like there's some universal model that works equally for all people with all needs, which is ridiculous. And this kind of, you know, I spoke yesterday or the day before on a podcast. There's a thing being advertised. I don't know if it's just across my platforms because I happen to be in this space, but every time I open my phone or open my computer, they're promoting this event that's online event that's global, and it's like, become superhuman. I'm like, such fucking bullshit, become superhuman, right?
Like telekinesis?
Oh, I'm like, I can fly. Like invisibility, like fucking reading minds, like, well,
if that is Kotler, and it sounds like him, he's got some really good stuff.
No.
I mean, obviously, it's not, okay. No, it's not
Kotler. No. It's I don't want to say what it is because I don't want to promote it, but it's essentially just kind of bullshit marketing to get people over the line. And it's misleading, it's misdirecting, and I just don't like it because it's not real, you know. And I'm not pretending, fuck, I run workshops, I write books, I have online mentoring, I get it. But I don't think it, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but it kind of shits me when people present themselves as the answer to people's pain. That annoys me.
Well, whether it's well-meaning, and a lot of times I think it probably is, and sometimes it's a bit duplicitous, to be fair. When you come from anything with the perspective that I have the answer, I change people's lives. I was given a seminar earlier today about this, where that it causes damage, and unwittingly causes damage, but causes damage nonetheless, because you're operating. Let's assume you have the best of intentions. You're operating through the lens of sympathy versus operating through the lens of empathy. And you negate the ability, the capacity of the person to find their own way forward. And you're going to start to create some cognitive biases around what's right thinking, what's wrong thinking, what's right for me. Like, I know people who I'm friends with, I'm colleagues with, and they have this thing where I posted something a while back about context, and like, there is no context. You create your own context. It's like, really? In every situation? Like, if you took a newborn baby, let's create some context, and you put that kid in a dark room, or not even a dark room, you just blindfolded that baby, which is a horrible thing to do to an infant. And you just didn't take that blindfold off. You did not let any light, you did not expose their visual cortex to any images for about 6 months. That baby would never see, because you have altered the occipital lobes of that baby's brain in such a way that they will be blind. And that is not a character flaw. It's not that they don't want sight for themselves. It's not that they're not willing to work for it, or they're not thinking, seeing thoughts. Their brain's been altered in a way that doesn't work. And we all accept that. Well, that's context. the context was the baby had a blindfold on. That was an environmental impediment that manifests now in serious consequences in their life. And we see somebody who's blind and we don't say, well, you need to have a better attitude towards seeing. We accept that. But when somebody's not engaging the behaviors we think they should be engaging in, we don't accept that the prefrontal lobes or the amygdala or the insula can have any issues whatsoever. That's got to be a character flaw. So explain to me the difference between a malfunction in the occipital versus the prefrontal lobes, because I don't get it.
Oh, wow. That is a beautiful analogy. I'm going to give you a 9.5 out of 10, an elephant stamp and a gold star, because that was very clever, my friend.
Gold star?
I am going to go back and listen to what you just said. That is a beautiful analogy and a beautiful comparison, and it does explain a lot. You know, two things come to mind. One, I interviewed Dylan last night, Dylan Keyes, who is, you know, the dude who does all the amazing drawing, the guy that I love, the artist who I promote. Have you seen him on my timeline?
Well, yeah, I've seen him on your timeline. That's how I know.
Yeah. So, you know, I was having a conversation last night with him and Melissa, and it's interesting when you experience the world through a brain and through a reality which is not like a lot of people's, you know, which is not say other people don't have similar issues to him. They do, but, you know, he's agoraphobic. He's suffers from like crippling chronic fatigue. He's dealing with constant anxiety, which is pretty much ever present, regular bouts of depression. But the strange thing is, and this sounds very naive and almost insensitive, I don't mean it to, but to look at him, like he's this good looking dude. He's this amazing talent. He speaks beautifully. He's really thoughtful and clever. And party is looking at him going, mate, is there really anything wrong? Because you look amazing. You know,
yeah, it's that. That is a painful situation. That must be a painful situation, or I suspect it's a painful situation for him.
Yeah. Because I know he really does struggle, and I know the pain is real, and the but I sensed last night in him the frustration that must be ever present with, I think he doesn't like socialization is not a big thing for him, because it's exhausting. Like he hasn't been to the supermarket for a year, for years. Mm-hmm. And I said to him last night, how long since you've been out and had dinner, like just out at a cafe or a restaurant? Did he say 6.5 years, Melissa?
I thought it was 9 years. I could be wrong, but it was a long time.
It was a long time, right? And it's just, he said, it's almost not worth it. It's just so exhausting for me, you know, and it's so overwhelming because like light, you know, sounds and stimulation and like external kind of things that are new in his kind of sphere, you know, they mess with his processing. And yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, that we look at other people's reality or what we think is reality or behavior or outcomes or even attitudes through our own filter, and then we judge what they do through our standards and values.
Yeah, we always interpret other people's behaviors by what our intentions would be. Mm. And sometimes, you know, there's a similarity. But it's kind of like theory of mind, isn't it? Like most 7-year-olds can start to understand that everybody has a brain like me and they feel and think like me, but different. And it's like we grasp that at 7 and then we lose it all at 27 in this society for some strange reason.
You were talking about treating someone with sympathy versus empathy. Explain that a bit.
The simplest way I can explain that is sympathy is where I feel for you. I really do. I care. But empathy is where I feel with you. I am imaginatively projecting myself into your thoughts and feelings and not editing or denying your reality, but cohabiting it. Sympathy, my focus is inward. It's how I feel. Oh, I feel so horrible about the situation that this person's in. Where empathy, my focus is outward on you. And the insidious nature of sympathy is I hold you as either unwilling or incapable of changing your situation. So therefore, you need my model. You need my insights. If you could just be like me, if you could do what I do, if you could think like I think, if you could work how I work, if you could value what I value, you'll be fixed. Because really, if you had what it took to be anywhere else than where you are right now, you would be. You must not be willing, or you must not be able. And that's insidious, and that's paralyzing. And that is, it's one of the worst rules of coaching to violate, or any type of interpersonal dynamic. Do not invalidate or deny someone's reality.
We're talking this morning with, or Tiff and I were talking with Mark Randolph, who I mentioned to you before the podcast, who created Netflix. He was the co-founder of Netflix and first CEO of Netflix. And he was talking about, you know, how for many people that, like, we're talking a little bit about, you know, building a business or a brand or a product or a service. We're talking about entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship, is that the word? Yeah, in general. And there's a lot of overlap between just growing something or doing something and overcoming something and creating something, be it in business or outside of business. But, you know, he said that the truth is that so many people just don't start. And you know, this is the thing, is that, like, people almost wait till they've got the confidence before they'll go and do something or try something. Whereas ironically, the confidence comes after we do and try, because it comes in the, you know, okay, I know that I won't be good at this, and I know that it will be hard, and I know that it might be scary, and I know that I might scrape my knees a few times, but that's okay. You know, how do we build competence and confidence and skill when, you know, our default setting is fear and anxiety and self-doubt and overthinking?
Well, that's a giant question. And I don't know, I'll try to break it down through my own experiences. For me, competence and confidence come hand in hand. I don't expect to be confident in a lot of things, because I am such shit in so many areas of my life where I could not, with any level of self-awareness and self-honesty, appraise myself based on past evidence as being particularly talented or better suited than anybody else. So not having confidence at first and really sucking at shit, it's kind of like my default. It's my baseline. But for me, it's always been learning. The more I can learn and the more I can get engaged and do something and have fun in the space of being shit. And sometimes that's hard when it's a profession or when you feel like there's a burden of responsibility. Where I'll give you an example. So I've mentioned this before. I'm working with arguably one of the greatest improvisational coaches on the planet. He's an individual who I think you would love to get on your podcast, David Rozowski. He is an extraordinarily interesting and talented individual. And do I have struggles with that? And I'm someone who, like you, is used to being on stage. It's like, damn, I am really bad at this, especially in the beginning. But it's fun, even though it's frustrating. Like, things that are frustrating but simultaneously important and that you're approaching through the lens of curiosity are rewarding, even in a state of frustration, especially in a state of frustration. But when it comes to work, let's say, I feel like I have a certain burden of responsibility to others. So it's a lot harder to reconcile that and allow myself that space to play as much as I think I should. So for me, it's a matter of embracing frustration as well as curiosity, being curious and allowing yourself to learn. Because if you're curious and something's important enough and you expect in advance to make mistakes, you're right. As you start to get more competent and execute on that, because we've talked about theory versus practice a lot. And I think both are critically important. If you're going to build a spaceship, you need some physicists that are steeped in theory, but then it's a different arena executing on the hypotheses you draw based on what you understand. And then when you execute on that, you're always going to get feedback. And if you're willing to engage, you approach something through play. As you start, for me anyway, as I start to deepen my knowledge base and my repetitions in something, I start to get more and more confident because you start to develop evidence. Because anytime you execute on something, two things are guaranteed to happen. You're going to screw shit up. And you can be at a master level or you can be at a novice. You're still going to screw things up. It's just what side of that scale are you on? And you're going to get certain things right. And you've got to have a mechanism for paying attention, recognizing, acknowledging both, because you'll start to build a pattern of what occurs when I perform really well and what are the elements that support that. So now you have an evidence base from which to build confidence upon. Another thing is physiology. I think a lot of times that people struggle with stuff. First questions I go to, are you sleeping? You know, how's the level of stress in your life? And again, that deals with perspective as well. Some people think, oh my God, I'm under so much stress. This is so detrimental to my health. Well, that is de-stress versus, oh, I feel on fire. I feel engaged. I'm so stressed out right now. You know, there's so much pressure. That could be, for those individuals, eustress. So how you view stress can determine it to a degree its effect that it has on your body and your performance. How's your diet? Are you training? Are you moving intermittently throughout the day? Because when you're dealing with your physiological issues, that can alleviate a lot of what we misinterpret as lack of confidence, because we have mental fatigue. We're struggling cognitively. And that doesn't give us the level of mental and emotional fortitude we need. Because here's how I see it. If you're engaging in something with the end in mind, you're looking for a result, whether that, let's say that's weight loss, or whether, let's say that's developing a new skill. Well, what produces results? Well, if you want to look at the most direct correlation between like cause and effect on results, the cause is your behaviors. The effect is whatever outcome results from that. So why is it? Because if you probably have noticed this with a lot of people you work with, you're coaching them through, they establish a set of behaviors, and some days they're absolute champions and they nail it. But then on other days they struggle. So there's this inconsistency. It's not that they can't get it right. They can't get it right consistently. It's like, what is all this vacillation in performance? You know, what's under that? And you know, some people would argue, well, it's your thought patterns on a daily basis that's and your perspectives and your rationalizations that's affecting your behaviors. Well, then what's underneath your perspectives, your attitudes, your thought patterns? What supports that? And there's a lot of evidence. And you know, I've had a conversation with a couple of neuroscientists personally around this. Emotions. Emotions are profoundly influential on how you see the world, your patterns of thought. So what's the key to emotion? The key to emotion is feeling. And a lot of times we don't have the intensity or the duration of an emotion to be able to perceive it. So when we're aware of an emotional state, we call that a feeling. So if emotions, when intense enough, or when they persist long enough, give rise to feelings, and feelings support thought patterns, attitudes, perspectives, which in turn support the next level behaviors, which have a direct effect on outcomes or results. What supports or what affects our emotional state? And what affects our emotional state is environment. And I'm not just talking about the world around you, but what is going on a cellular level? What's going on neurophysiologically within you? So a lot of traditional wellness-based practices, they're not about wellness. They're about anything that's important to you. Because they support everything all the way up that chain. So competence and how's your physiology and, you know, how do you approach things in your life? What I think is the most, for me anyway, the most important thing in my world is beauty. I don't mean like physical beauty. I mean, areas of performance, literature, film, all of that, and play. Because play is this, it could be this space for unbound intellectual exploration and collaboration, where you're not attached to a certain methodology and you have that level of curiosity that emerges from a mindset of play, if you will, that allows you to go where you need to go and see what happens and experiment. So experiments about what you learn.
Beautiful. So good. You're on fire today. I want you to take that nicotine gum that you took before. I want you to do that every episode.
By the way, that was the worst advice you've ever given me.
I didn't give you that advice.
You were like, oh, the nicotine. I popped the nicotine gum. I would chew it. And I felt like all shaky and nervous. I felt like something was wrong. I was like paranoid. I don't know. That was crazy.
No idea what you're talking about. This is a question without notice. What's more in our control, our emotions or our thoughts?
I'm not 100% sure how to answer that because emotions and thoughts are so interconnected. They're so inseparably linked. But if I had to choose one, I mean, seriously, like most of the thoughts we're having in a day are unconscious.
Yeah, happen despite us. And our emotions happen despite us to an extent. But can we self-regulate emotions? Like emotion just happens.
Well, I'll default to thought because you have things like cognitive behavior therapy and you can examine your thoughts and you can examine your methodologies and self-talk. Mm. And, you know, you could look back and go, wait, hold on. How did I react to that? You know, what was that trigger that caused that response? And then how did that feel? What was the consequence of what is that thing I was saying to myself? Well, is that true? So you could dispute your thoughts. So if I had to pick, I would say that thoughts are more in our control than emotions, because a lot of times we're not even sure what emotional state we're in. And it's like controlling your emotions is kind of like telling somebody to run 100 meters as fast as they can. But whatever you do, don't allow your heart rate to accelerate. It's not going to happen. You know, so every emotion we have is critical for survival. So they're automatic and they influence our thoughts. But yeah, given those two choices in that question, thoughts.
What do you think precedes? Do you think that emotion always precedes, sometimes precedes thought, the other way around? Do you think, because I know that if I focus on something or I take my mind to a place, I can create emotional response, but also sometimes I will feel an emotion and that will take my mind down a path. So I think it's interchangeable, but what do you think?
For me, I think yes, absolutely.
Mm.
And you, we've all had that experience where you're feeling kind of good, you know, and then you drive by this restaurant and it's like, oh, I remember that restaurant. You know, that's where she broke up with me.
So many restaurants.
She was sleeping with my brother. I mean, that you know, that's going to be upsetting. That's going to give rise to a certain emotional state.
And for your brother. But enough about you and your brother. I think also when we talk about competence and confidence and, you know, getting shit done and making progress and, you know, opening the door on the newer and the better and the self-growth and that whole journey. You know, there are things that we are confident with and simultaneously things that we have zero confidence in, you know. So ironically, like my job essentially is speaking, you know, well, that's part of my job. Obviously, there's a bit of thinking that goes with it. But and I don't want to bang on about this because I've already shared it, but you know, when I, like you, when I go and do a presentation or a whatever, a workshop or a camp or a whatever, my dominant emotion is excitement, curiosity, how will this go? Who's going to be there? How will it be received? There's generally nothing negative. There's generally very little worry or concern or anxiety. But when I had to do my, it's called confirmation presentation at the end of the first year of my PhD, where, okay, so what I'm doing is I'm standing in front of a group like I have 1 million times and I'm speaking. Well, everyone's like, oh, you'll nail that. That's what everybody says. You'll nail it. I'm like, no, I tell you why I won't nail it. Because the people that are listening to me are literally evaluating me and they're going to say whether or not I can keep doing my PhD. That's literally what's going to happen. So one, that so no makes pressure. Me feel, yeah, no pressure. They're either going to go, you need to go back and, you know, do more work, come back in a few months, try again, or no, you can't continue your PhD, but have a good life, or yes, right? Green light. And I remember, like, I never have sleepless nights. I had a sleepless, almost sleepless night the night before. And because I rely on intuition and instinct and humor and creating energy and building engagement and reading the audience and creating an experience every time I talk, now all of a sudden, all of those things are out the window. Like none of that matters. And by the way, these guys that are going to give you the green light or red light, they don't give a fuck about you. They don't know you. I don't know who you are. You're just student number 37,142 and you're the 20th one of these they've done this week with the 20th student. And it's funny how I felt so exposed and so vulnerable and so uncomfortable and so terrified doing something that is a very, very similar version of what I do for a job.
That sounds daunting. When did you present? What time of day?
About 2 o'clock.
Oh wow, that's a horrible time of day too.
Yeah, yeah. I wish
you're already tired. Yeah. Did you hear about that research from Dan Ariely on Israeli judges? They are more likely to refuse parole or issue harsher sentences
after lunch.
Well, no, when they've had a break, they're actually more lenient. So like after lunch, after a break, first thing in the morning, right. Best time to get in front of the judge. You get them at the end of the day when they're like, they've heard it, they're all pissed off. Yeah, it doesn't look good for you.
He's such an interesting dude, that guy, Dan Ariely. Mm-hmm. He's
brilliant.
Yeah. And what he went through himself with his burns and his recovery. And I'm thinking of the right guy, aren't I?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. How's the show going anyway? How's the podcast?
I'm having fun. Had a guest on today. I've known this guy for ages. So I hired this guy a long, long time ago. Let's put it that way, as a trainer. And then he moved into sales and like he's arguably one of the most successful entrepreneurs in the fitness industry. So Eric Casabiri, great guy.
What number episode will that be?
I think 14. I'm just doing one a week right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been fun. You know, I've loved having all of my guests, except one. I'm not going to mention who that is.
Yeah, that guy.
Don't worry. It's not you.
That guy. Well, the thing is, though, that it's good. You're better off to do one good episode a week and have one great conversation a week than try and crank out a bunch if you're not, you know, geared up for it. And like I literally have Melissa and Tiff and they're always getting great people for me. And, you know, we're, but it, for the first year, Melissa and I were talking about this on air a little while ago. For the first year, we were doing one or two a week. And then there was a period, I think one Christmas, was it, Melissa, where we did like, we didn't do an episode for like 3 or 4 weeks.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It took forever, but
well, mate, I just want to be consistent.
Yeah. Well, we love chatting with you as always. Where can people catch up with you and follow you?
I don't even want to say the self-help antidote because it's like, I'm like, yeah, I'm still building that website. It's the longest running website build in history. But pretty soon, the selfhelpantidote.com. You could find the self-help antidote on multiple platforms, on Google, Spotify, you know, Apple, iHeartRadio. I'm sparingly less and less on social media. Like, I don't know, like Instagram, Facebook.
Why is social media? Why is that?
Because the less time I spend on social media, regardless of how I'm engaging with it, the happier I am.
Well, that's a good reason, dude. All right, mate. Well, we love you. Stay on the call. Thank you for coming on yet again. Melissa, thank you.
Thank you both of you.
Love you guts, team. See you next time.
The addict in your family might need you to take the first step for them. They Have Private Hospital for Addiction Treatment has the experience, staff, resources, and processes to help you help your loved one. DAHAB's model of intensive rehabilitation has revolutionised the practice of addiction treatment in Australia. Registered with the DHHS, Department of Health and Human Services, DAHAB now offers rehabilitation programs for drug, alcohol and gambling addiction and is a private health fund approved treatment service. So if you or someone you care about is fighting addiction, there is hope. Addiction is treatable. Recovery is possible. Just ask me, call. And there is light at the end of the tunnel. DAHAB Private Hospital for Addiction Treatment. Call DAHAB on 1-800-329-422 or learn more at DAHAB, DAYHAB, or one word, .com.au.